Hi, I'm James Palmer. I'm a senior editor here at Foreign Policy, specializing in China, where I lived for 15 years. This past week, the People's Republic marked 70 years of communist rule. Looming over the celebration, of course, was Xi Jinping, the increasingly repressive Chinese leader who has consolidated more power there than any figure since Mao. To understand where the country is going, I pulled two of the smartest China analysts around into the FP studio. Jude Blanchett, who holds the Freeman Chair in China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Ray Zhong, the Program Associate for the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Wilson Center. Here's our conversation. Jude, you've written extensively about the nature of Chinese power and Chinese leadership. What can we tell from these celebrations about how strong Xi Jinping is and what he wants to do with the country?
Yeah, good question. I think we probably are overemphasizing the festivities of October 1st as a metric in and of itself for Xi Jinping's power. There's never been a celebration of the founding of the PRC where they haven't invested a significant amount in the pomp and circumstance of it. So if we go back 10 years, I was in Beijing at the time, you saw a pretty impressive array of military apparatus rolling through the streets. You saw the security crackdown. You saw the planes overhead. But of course, this year, it's invested with, I think, an even more significance because we're looking at a general secretary of the Communist Party of China, Xi Jinping's more important title, where he's facing arguably the most challenges of any general secretary since perhaps 1989 with June 4th, or even in the immediate period after the death of Mao Zedong in 1976. So the question on everyone's mind and what we're all scrambling to look for signals and signs is just how powerful is Xi Jinping as a leader? And unfortunately, in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, collectively we gave up on the old Kremlinologist pursuit, which is attempting to find metrics for evaluating power.
How does Xi's image differ from previous leaders in terms of how prominent it is and how much time is placed on it?
When you look at the resources that Xi and the Chinese Communist Party have poured into proactive propaganda, you're starting to see more of it aimed at young people, at tech-savvy people. This morning I saw a collaboration between Tencent and state media that allowed you
Tencent is a big gaming company, we should
Right. Tencent, the large multimedia and gaming conglomerate, collaborated with the Chinese government to roll out a game where you could simulate building different types of infrastructure to commemorate the 70th anniversary. So you're starting to see a lot of resources poured into things aimed at young people, at people that are online using mobile devices all the time. And this is very much in the spirit of playing the long game and making sure that Xi thought is accessible in as many forms as there are platforms.
Are these games good?
Well, I'm actually really curious about how the Tencent Chinese infrastructure game feels, because they aren't amateurs at building games. They've invested heavily in international entertainment, movies in addition to games. And in these commercial spaces, they are becoming a bigger and bigger player. So as they're moving more freely in cultural spaces, it's still important to remember their political prerogatives, which still can be traced back to the Chinese government.
So these things are being built around certain incentives kind of pushed by the government. But even like, how does this bleed into kind of like the regular commercial center, into regular sort of, so say Tencent just wants to make money. How much does it have to think about the party?
Well, Tencent can be stopped by government initiatives. This company specifically faced a freeze in gaming approvals that lasted quite some time. I believe it started last year and it lasted until sometime earlier this year. But these freezes are serious business for Tencent's revenue. And so even though it clashes with government regulators on what content to include, what content not to include, I think we've seen the least pushback from Tencent or any commercial firms in China when it comes to putting she thought promotion into the games, movies, television that they're producing.
This seems to be, I think, a pattern across the board that we've seen, that the private sector has much less power to resist the government than it did in, say, the 2000s or the early 2010s. Now, of course, you know, there were always limits as to how much you could resist the government. There were lines that couldn't be crossed, but there was a sense of being able to push back against certain initiatives that seems to have sort of, would you say that, see, that's right, that some of that sense has dissolved?
Yeah, without a doubt. I think this is part and parcel with the party expanding out into areas of Chinese society where it felt that it didn't have purview or didn't have a sense of what was happening. You know, if we go back to 2001, when then General Secretary of the CCP, Jiang Zemin, announced this idea of, in Marxist speak, the three represents, which was an attempt to get integrate capitalists into the Communist Party. At the time, we interpreted that as a victory for global capitalism over the Communist Party. In retrospect, it's apparent that this was the beginning of a concerted effort to make sure the party was inserted into and had at least some oversight of what was happening in this rapidly expanding private sector.
So it's the anaconda and the chandelier, to use Peiling's old phrase, where he compared the situation of Chinese to diners underneath a chandelier around which a large snake is coiled, and the snake can drop down at any time. You're always aware of the snake, but that doesn't mean that everything you do is aimed at pleasing the snake. Right. You're trying in many cases to just sort of get on with things. Do you think that this reassertion of the state that we're seeing is something that was always going to happen, that was inevitable? Is it something that Xi himself has driven, has pushed?
Well, it did take Xi some time from when he came to power in 2013 until now to assert his authority and consolidate people within the party. But at this point, I think it's not controversial amongst China analysts that he has consolidated a foothold within China's political and cultural elite. He's written his Xi Jinping thought permanently into the Chinese constitution.
Permanently is always a slightly odd phrase with the Chinese constitution,
right,
since it gets changed so often.
Right. But it has been put formally
alongside the
placed into it.
Deng and Mao. Is it Deng and Mao who are also in there? I forget.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao do not have their own leadership doctrines.
Huge disappointment to their mothers. They're just like, all that effort and you couldn't even get in the constitution.
I remember someone at Foreign Policy, I forget who, wrote a very good piece a couple of years ago about the non-inevitable rise of Xi Jinping. and the point made by this great anonymous piece, and I don't know who wrote it, but was that, look,
I mean, all I remember the author is he's handsome. It's a...
You know, contingencies matter in Chinese politics as they do in every other political system. And so clearly, you know, if we go back to 2007, right, so before Xi Jinping had firmly been declared as the successor, there was a leadership competition between him and the current premier of the State Council, a guy named Li Keqiang, who is a much softer temperament than Xi Jinping, I think we could say. We can imagine a counterfactual where out of the smoky backroom bargaining between party elite, Li Keqiang emerges triumphant and he's the general secretary. I think it's clear we wouldn't be where we are today on so many issues. Xi Jinping as a particular leader mattered in driving these forward. But if we zoom out even further, you know, the Communist Party is coming up on its 100th anniversary. Probably the enigma or the anomaly in the Communist Party's 100-year history is the past couple decades where it was trending more towards integration with the global economy and a broadly speaking more liberal, tolerant approach to civil society. That, to me, seems to be the anomaly out of the 100-year history.
Do you think that anomaly was deliberate, that it was something that people in the party were actively pushing, or was it a result almost of the relative weakness of the party at the time, where you had these power struggles going on between Hu and Jiang after Hu took over? Jiang didn't want to give up on his people, so you had these fights inside the party. You had this sense of the private sector strengthening. Was there an aim, do you think, to liberalize, to integrate with the world economy, or was it just relative sort of weakness of the state?
I think there's definitely a pragmatic angle to that, because at the time of the Jiang Zemin to Hu Jintao transition, China was still industrializing, and there were, of course, questions of, as there are in every power transition in China, of would China stay stable through this? So at the time, because China was still industrializing, plus you had the political transition question, they probably didn't want to risk any political instability that would arise from changing the economic model too much, because China's obviously not a representative democracy, but one of the factors that people really notice is how well the economy is doing. And so economic performance has always been something that the party has tried to manage as China's economy opened up.
Coming back to the present day, we talk about economic performance as one of the kind of foundations of how the public measures kind of the performance of the state, the party. And we seem to be seeing a lot of signs of slowdown, of problems in the Chinese economy. You have whole areas in Dongbei in the northeast that are in outright recession. You have the collapses of banks. You have all these signs that things are not going well. How is the party at this very sensitive political time? How is the party trying to cope with the economic slowdown? What messages is it sending out?
You know, at base, the Communist Party is able to stay in power, or a given ruling coalition stays in power, because the pie is getting big enough that you can redistribute rents to the folks in your coalition, right? So at just the...
By rents, but let's be a little clearer on what we mean by rents.
You're able to distribute booty and resources to folks who are there to keep you in power. And so these would be people in the state sector, security services, military, and key companies in the private sector. That's how authoritarian leaders stay in power. So there's a baseline where the party is always concerned about economic performance and the size of the pie. For a long time, as outsiders, we looked at China's economy and the ability for the Communist Party to maintain it. There seemed to be this almost magical ability of Chinese regulators to always pull a rabbit out of a hat. And so China again and again has been able to survive these periods of economic weakness. 2008 global financial crisis, 1997 Asian financial crisis. So the question now that's lingering over all this is, are Chinese regulators facing this extraordinary, complicated external and domestic environment able to yet again pull a rabbit out of a hat? Now, one of the ways we can just think about that is, how much pressure is the party putting on individuals who are trying to speak openly and actually analyze how the economy is performing? And still to this day, you see them investing extraordinary resources to make sure they alone are the arbiter of China's health, economic health, I should say.
I would add to what Jude was saying that, as with a lot of industrialization stories, China's story is not a story of a rising tide lifts all boats. Poverty alleviation has been a stated goal of the Chinese Communist Party for decades now. However, in its industrialization and its path to develop a service economy, which is the current goal, we haven't necessarily seen growth that benefits all aspects of the Chinese population. For example, much of China's current service economy relies on rural workers that have moved to the city. They're called migrant workers. They will often be working within China's informal economy, doing hospitality or trades. They're living further out from city centers.
And they're being driven deliberately further out from city centers.
As real estate projects develop, the housing and service access for them is a bigger and bigger question. But how China's government effectively works is that local governments have to raise their own revenues a lot of the time. And because they're cash-strapped to begin with, the capacity of a lot of rural provinces to run programs to boost employment or local economic activity is kind of limited as a result.
And we've seen, I guess, because of this kind of reassertion of central power under Xi, even some of that local, already fairly diminished local ability has shrunk further.
Yeah, and this is one where the party itself has been fairly open and transparent about addressing some of these problems with how lower-level bureaucrats, or cadres, as they're called in a communist system, are or are not responding to commands from the top. Since we've seen the start of the anti-corruption campaign under Xi Jinping, which started in 2013, a tactic that bureaucrats have adopted to make sure that they don't get called out for something is called buzowei, so just inaction or foot dragging. The party has a classification of about 10 of these different types of behaviors that bureaucrats are engaged in. If you've worked in a large organization in the United States, you've seen this behavior yourself. This is a classic tactic for anyone who wants to exist in a big bureaucracy and shirk tasks.
I mean, I wouldn't know anything about that. Here we're at foreign policy, we're all 100% committed to foreign policy thought.
So the question is Xi Jinping certainly believes, or the Xi administration believes, that this is having a significant effect on governance capacity. This is why they're investing quite a lot of resources in grabbing the whip and cracking it on bureaucrats. The problem is that they've got a one-way solution, which is to continue to tighten oversight over cadres. And so the Goldilocks permissible space of action for a local level cadre is becoming narrower and narrower.
One of the things that I feel like happens, too, is that when you get this pressure to sort of do something, to be seen to be doing something, the easiest thing to do is always, in turn, to tighten your grip on other people. It's always to demonstrate repression. Positive measures are a lot riskier for a local government official to take. So over the course of, say, the next year or so, if the economy continues to weaken, to get worse, if the U.S.-China trade war drags on and on and on, or if global recession comes, as looks, frankly, increasingly likely, how do you think the party will respond? What's going to happen?
Well, so far, the party-issued rhetoric seems to entrench China as an entity that can keep fighting, that can toughen up, that can go through economic hardship if it can pull out what the party deems to be wins over the United States. They've also been paying a lot of attention to the negotiation process and have been aware of when deals don't look to be particularly productive with the United States. So you're seeing an increased sensitivity to how the trade war impacts China's public image as an economic power and its longer-term economic trajectory.
Do you think, I mean, we hear a lot about, like, the Chinese people are strong, the Chinese people are tough. And every time this happens, I think the Chinese people haven't really seen a recession for three decades. Do you think the Chinese public is tough? Do you think that they can take the impact of a recession? I mean, we have this idea that people are sort of used to eating bitterness. But we have, you know, generations now that, not necessarily in the countryside, but certainly in the city, have grown up in relative comfort. And not just comfort, but in the expectation that things would get better the next year, or at least get better if you were in that class. Is it a shock to the system when that changes?
I think it's a good point about we're not only for the party but for the Chinese people as well. We're entering a period of firsts. Xi Jinping has been tightening political control because what they say they want to do is to be able to govern during a crisis. The Communist Party has not had to govern during a crisis for a very long time. And if we see an event like, let's say, Hong Kong or U.S.-China relations or something in the Asia Pacific in terms of South China Sea or East China Sea, if we see a conflagration or if we see a sudden change of the status quo, we have absolutely no idea how Xi Jinping is going to rule and is going to govern during a crisis, and that should concern all of us.
I guess he hasn't faced an external crisis, but to some degree, the degree of struggle within the party over the last few years has been an internal crisis. We've seen numerous people purged. We've seen he's clearly had enemies. So there's some degree, like, we know he's come through or a period of, like, bloodletting.
Yeah, but so dealing with an intra-party purge, which takes an extraordinary amount of skill, don't get me wrong, is of just a different kind from, let's say, dealing with an international incident like death in Hong Kong, let's say, by a protester at the hands of a police officer. Or let's, you know, Taiwan is now moving towards a significantly volatile situation. We've got the elections coming up next January, or events in the South China Sea, right? So I think that'll take a type of mettle and a type of dexterity, which we haven't seen Xi Jinping have to act yet.
To add to that, Xi's toolkit for dealing with domestic issues differs from what he has to deal with international issues. He, in domestic-facing situations, the media can be censored. Officials can that aren't doing something he likes can be summarily removed. But in international spaces, and even in peripheral spaces like Hong Kong, he has to think about, well, if I remove Carrie Lam, who do I put in that can functionally stabilize the situation? So the decisions to be made there have, I think, different costs and benefits. And then the whatever he opts for looks different to international actors and also to domestic actors, because the for example, going back to possibly replacing Carrie Lam as the Hong Kong chief executive, that plays much differently in China than it might
removing a provincial party secretary a governor, right?
Yeah.
I totally agree. This is just infinitely more complex, even though administratively, it should be
theoretically the same, but people outside the system care about and the other isn't. So, I mean, something like, say, replacing Carrie Lam, do you think that would be seen as a sign of weakness inside the party? Is that one of the reasons why we haven't seen the perennially unpopular chief executive of Hong Kong kicked out yet?
I think one aspect of that hypothetical move would be to somehow find a way to spin it for the Chinese public, because what the Chinese public has been getting from the news, from legitimate news apps and less legitimate ones over social media, has been that Lam is a source of stability and the Hong Kong police are a source of stability. So if the party suddenly decides that Lam is not suitable for the position, they're going to need a reason to explain it. One of the tactics that comes to mind, I think, is just the selectivity of what the Chinese state-run media chooses to give oxygen to. Like, for example, they're very selective about which U.S. political events come to light within Chinese news apps and news feeds.
Give us some examples. Which ones do they leave out? Or,
for example, when Mike Pence made a speech on China at the Hudson Institute, they ran it very selectively and removed certain lines. So sometimes they'll sort of go through American politicians' speeches, rhetoric, or public appearances with a scalpel, tailor out certain parts, and then run a partial article of the event. So if the party decides to switch tactics on the Scarborough Shoal, even though that's kind of unlikely to happen,
I know, there's
probably some kind of state media protocol that can make the magic happen.
I like the image. They just have a little box for, you know, all contingencies up to and including Taiwan is not part of China anymore. Just
Also, I think moving this outside of China, flip-flopping governments and politicians and political actors have been doing this for time immemorial, right? So I don't think we should overestimate how limited the party is to course correct, right? And so with certain key constituencies, you absolutely take a credibility hit if you make a sudden shift on a given policy. But one example is, for better part of three decades, since 1982, China was celebrating the idea that it had put term limits in place for the office of the presidency, and this was necessary if we were not going to go back to the Mao era. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, I started seeing a scrubbing of that and talking about how we had to have a unification of the three offices of Central Military Commission, head of the party, and the head of the president, which was a explicit reversal, a 180 from three decades of party propaganda, right? They did it. I remember a few people remarked on it, and here we are today, and we're not talking about it that much. So,
we're not talking about it, but that was one of the events that for my Chinese friends who I would say were previously, who I would have previously said were moderately strong party supporters, it was a real shock. They were genuinely thrown.
So undoubtedly, in some key constituencies, you take a credibility hit. But my point is, if the party believes it needs to make a redirect, it'll make a redirect. And I don't think now we're looking at the party as being structurally significantly weaker because of a core redirect that it did last March when it abandoned or abolished term limits. So of course they'll redirect. And also in this age of sort of fake media and state propaganda, their tools are evolving on how to manage. And manage the sort of framing of some of these. If it does, for example, need to can Carrie Lam, of course they will. And they'll say she's been unable to uphold her responsibilities as the chief executive of Hong Kong and maintain the peace and the unity. So this isn't a victory for the protesters. This is actually about protecting China's national interests. So we're putting someone else in.
And if they don't have anything else, they can always look into politicians' personal finances.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It's very easy to discover, you know, a few
That's
million dollars
and, you, right?
and a few dozen mistresses.
You know, it's not my decision.
Like, I remember, you know, particularly at the city level, you'll have a guy fall and then suddenly, like, everybody will have a million stories. And most of those stories, I think, are true about his malfeasance. And it's almost like, you know, they've had this stuff, like, just jammed up, waiting to go for a long time.
And it's not just politicians either, because we had this Fan Bingbing, who's an actress who's been in lots of international films, effectively go off the mat for several months because of tax cheating. So a lot of times when somebody gets dinged for personal finances, it's not just about them, but it also sets an example for other public figures.
With the celebrities, too, there's always this sense of just reminding people that they're owned, I think. Like, remember who pulls the strings. So going back to this point of, like, you know, the party can redirect, the party can change. I mean, thinking of, you know, the Republican Party in the United States, which in 2015, if you polled Republicans, something like 79% said that they were pro-free trade. If you polled the same people 3 years later, about 40% said that they were pro-free trade. The entire position had flip-flopped to follow the party. And this seems to be something that we see even in democratic societies, that party identity, party affiliation, overrides actual positions, actual policy. How much do you think the Chinese public identifies with the party itself? And how much do they see the party as the country? How much do they see the party's interests as the country's interests?
Yeah, it's a good question. And again, to I think what we were talking about earlier, we don't have a really robust set of polling data that gives us a very accurate idea about this. And a lot of, you know, there's an idea of preference falsification where people act as if they believe a certain way just because of group dynamics. And so support that we hear people having for the party or for Xi Jinping, I think everyone should take it with a grain of salt outside of an environment where it's costless to articulate dissent. That being said, I think clearly identification with the Communist Party as a steward of national stability will find much more sympathy than the party as a vehicle for, you know, ideological projects that it has. I think the Buang Chuxin, you know, don't forget your original intentions propaganda campaign that's going on right now under Xi Jinping about the Communist Party getting back to its sickle and hammer roots in the caves of Yan'an in the 1940s is unlikely to be a very stirring national ideology. But that's why the party always has multiple areas or multiple vectors for sort of regime support. It's economic performance. It's international, right? It's this narrative of for 150 years we were we were carved up by colonialists, and the party is here to protect territorial integrity and the safety of the Chinese people. So it shifts around in terms of what it emphasizes from day to day. But I don't think the ideological constructs are particularly appealing.
Ray, would you agree?
I would say I agree. Also, another part of this is that she has a lot of personal popularity. People think that he is ushering China into more economic prominence, more prominence in terms of international standing. And I mean, obviously, some of this has been encouraged by propaganda and state media. But at the same time, the sense that the Chinese Communist Party is able to maintain social stability and economic stability, that is the biggest thing that people will fall back on in terms of maintaining the status quo.
And sort of stick an eye in, stick a finger in the eye of foreigners too. I feel that like that's part of the appeal, like the idea of, because there's so much emphasis on, you know, humiliation, dominance, all this kind of thing.
The century of humiliation, but now, I think, a lot of Chinese people, whether they're ride or die for the Chinese Communist Party or more interested in can I get food on the table, they don't necessarily want their nation to be in a humiliating position. And they see China where it is right now as at that kind of turning point from humiliation to somewhere new.
To strength, to sort of power. And I mean, I think, you know, it's funny thinking of America again after 9/11, where there was that sense that the country had been hurt, had been humiliated, had been crippled, and that need to strike back. Almost this kind of shock that a country that saw itself as naturally powerful, as naturally ascendant. And we see that, I think, in China, too, like this sense that China should be number one. China deserves to be number one by virtue of history, by virtue of population, all this kind of thing. When it comes to sort of to the ideology, do you think the least popular part of the Chinese Communist Party is the communism?
Yeah, that's certainly the C of the CCP that they get the most flack for in terms of an apparent abandonment of it. Look, I don't think really at any time in the last 60 years has there been a serious and even nominal commitment by the CCP to a stricter definition of moving towards a communist society. And really, we've just seen utilizing some of the ideological loopholes by people like Deng Xiaoping saying, look, let's go full on capitalism right now, or let's go market reform, because actually that's a return to the old Marxist vision of a transition period through accumulation of productive forces. But look, I don't think there's an appetite even within the Communist Party for the communist part of it. There's certainly an appetite for the structural organizational elements of a Leninist party. But that's distinct from
we do get a lot of, Ray was saying, we do get a lot of this poverty alleviation language. Under Xi, in fact, there seems to be something of a
But that's not connected to the C. Look, you'd be hard-pressed to find most countries which don't have a part of their agenda is something about poverty alleviation, right? And I think probably more importantly for China is this socialist identity, which I think runs much stronger than the communist identity. And I do think you still have a strong current of nominal socialist adherence that still drives and underlines policy. And that's what they articulate as a vision, much more so than communism. Communism now just means Leninism.
And certain types of communists, if they stray too far from being friendly to the powers that be, are not necessarily out of the line of fire, as we can see from
the
club members,
Peking
University's Marxist club traveled to South China to organize electronics workers in a firm called JASIC. Then the workers and I think local trade union staffers were all put into jail as a result of their demonstrations.
I mean, I almost wonder if part of this is, you know, we know that they made a very intense study of the Soviet Union in the 1980s. And one of the things you see in the Soviet Union is the system is brought down by true believers in communism.
Right.
Gorbachev is a sincere believer in communism who believes in reform as a way of eventually achieving a communist society. Yeah. So do you think, like, if you're, you know, you get to your party meeting and you're like, you know, oh, great comrades, I can't wait to talk about Das Kapital. Yeah. How does that go down?
Well, even certain interpretations of Mao are now out of vogue with what governs the party effectively now. So it seems like right now just about the only thing that's safe is centering your policymaking and thought on Xi Jinping thought.
Just real quick, I think just historically speaking, once communists get to power, they have no room for actual communists.
Just to wrap this up, will anything change in the next few years? Are we just going to be going down the same course of more tightening, more more Xi Jinping, more sort of nationalism, or is there anything that would send the country in another direction?
I think, look, if we're sitting down 12 months from now, or 24 months from now, this will not have just been a normal 2 years or a year. This is going to be a time of extraordinary political and geopolitical upheaval. The U.S.-China deterioration of relations is just getting started. That is undoubtedly going to propel forward developments in China's political system. I fear for the worse. But I don't think it remains a status quo tightening. I think we could possibly see a significant trajectory change in the tightening. This is an iron law of authoritarian politics. You know, the more power you have, the more paranoid you get. We've taken off the table the idea of a sort of Stalin-era 1930s Great Terror in China. 5 years ago, I would have agreed with that, thought that was more or less impossible. But given the political dynamics now that exist internationally and within China, I no longer think such developments are completely off the table.
I think that because China's angling to be seen and to act more as a leader in the East Asia region, instability in Asia is also something that I think might test China's governance capacity significantly. So, for example, North Korea developments, a potential scenario where Japan revokes Article 9 of its constitution
and the pacifist clause,
allows itself to raise an army again. There are multiple scenarios that could really put a lot of in-region pressure on China, in addition to what Jude mentioned.
And on that cheery note, we're going to end up for today. Jude Ray, thank you so much for coming in. It's great to talk to you. And we look forward to doing this again.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to my guests, Ray Zhong, Program Associate at the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Wilson Center.
Thank you.
And Jude Blanchett, Freeman Chair in China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Thank you, James.